Welcome to the Adventure Audio Podcast. This is episode 165. And for the first time in 165 episodes, I'm not actually on this episode of the podcast. One of the challenges of podcasting is, especially with busy people, is schedules. This is a guest that we're super happy to have on. We had to reschedule numerous times in order to make it work. And then we ran into a conflict with my schedule and we thought, you know what, let's just roll with it. So this is Laval and Dr. Chris Bertram, who is an associate professor at the University of the Fraser Valley. And they are having a fascinating conversation, and I just got a sneak preview of it because I've edited the episode about flow state and what that means to athletes. I'm not going to spoil anything. It is really, really excellent. It's exactly the kind of engaging conversation that you would expect Laval to lead. So very sorry to Chris who have missed this episode. Thank you so much for making the time to spend with Laval. I hope we get to have you back on, Chris. Thank you so much. And a quick shout out to Duer. You can visit them. It's D-U-E-R at Duer.ca. Award visit the Calgary store. Duer has performance apparel. They are a supporter of the podcast, and we greatly appreciate that. So give them a visit online or go and visit the store in person and tell them that Pete and Laval sent you. One more thank you to Chris Bertram for joining us. Everybody, thank you so much for listening to the podcast. We'll be back as soon as we can, and I'll be on the next episode. Thanks again.
So what would you call that?
Well, I call it mental performance coaching because I don't know that there's the proper title for it. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a sports psychologist, but I'm very much interested in how to get the operating system up here in the head working to get our bodies to do all the things we're trying to get them to do when we're, when we're under pressure and just when we want to express all the things that we've learned how to do. How do you do that in the most optimal fashion?
I find it fascinating that part of your teachings or part of your philosophy on this is trying to get us to tame our prefrontal cortex so that we can get into a flow state, which is sort of, to me, goes against the way I would anticipate that stress-resistant learning or learning in the type of environments that I'm training guys in as an airline pilot, It seems to me like you wouldn't want to do that. But once I've dug into it, I can see that makes sense. So we're going to talk about that as well. But how did you go from being somebody who specialized in human motor control to this field? So your human motor control, to me, I'm thinking neck down, but yeah, obviously we've got this control center up here, but how did that evolve?
Yeah, well, originally, so when I started in grad school, I was really interested in this field of human motor behavior, which has a few sort of subfields underneath it. One of them is called motor development, which really focuses on kids and how, you know, we hit certain developmental milestones, and we've all gone through this as a parent where you're, what's the height? What's the weight? And there's this sort of natural development curve, and then you track it across a lifespan. That's not so much what I focus on. The other two areas of motor behavior, one is called motor learning, and the other is motor control. So how does our motor system learn new skills? And then once we've learned them, how is the entire nervous system controlling those skills, right? And that's going to change as we continue to grow and get better at these things. So that's what I was really interested in. And probably the part of it that I focused the most on is the learning piece. So what does that even mean? How would we define learning? What actually happens on the inside of us when we learn a new skill? That's been a real area of interest of mine. And then it sort of started to go into, okay, well, understanding the basic mechanisms of learning and what's going on inside, how can we alter our environments to help optimize that process so we could get better a little bit more quickly, right? So that's where, once you start getting into the game of how to learn faster, then all of a sudden it becomes, you know, this is where I start to morph into a bit more of the psychology. Again, I'm not a psychologist, but if you're trying to figure out how somebody can learn and set up conditions for somebody to learn, and you're not paying attention to the fact that that person has a mind and a psychology, and a history, you're just not going to be able to engage in that process as well as you otherwise would. And so I certainly have, I work alongside in certain teams with psychologists and sports psychologists to help sort of dovetail these two approaches together. But it's something that I also just have gotten very interested in. And I, and especially in my own private coaching practice, it's a really important element of it. And so then it just became, all right, so what are all the pieces that, you know, build this puzzle of how to show up and be your best on any given day? So part of that is the psychology. Part of it is what you're doing with the external environment, how that's affecting your internal environment for learning. And then what is the underlying biology? So a lot of the time I spend talking about, you know, how we sleep, because ultimately learning happens when we're asleep. That's where consolidation occurs. So that brings in this whole other area of sleep performance as a foundational component of mental performance. You could say the same about nutrition and gut health and hydration. These are all of the variables that come into play when we are trying to optimize our nervous system for, you know, high performance.
So it started with the motor learning, and then is it because of your background in sports that you started to focus on this aspect of it, or is it because you read the only book I've ever read on flow by Csikszentmihalyi?
Yeah,
sort of the granddaddy of flow. Is that what got you going?
Yeah, first of all, kudos on getting the name right. That's not an easy task. Yeah, I mean, certainly I grew up playing sports. It was a passion of mine from the time I was a kid. And you know, I competed at a pretty high level in a couple of different sports and always fascinated. I've always been a really competitive person, and I always, like, I'm an avid watcher of sports. I love watching, you know, growing up, the Gretzky's and the Jordans, and these days it's the LeBrons and the Patrick Mahomes of the world, and just trying to demystify and decode what it is these people are doing. And I'm fascinated by it. And as, especially in the last 15 or 20 years, the science of, you know, the neuroscience and the neuroimaging that has come along for the ride, that's helping to look inside the brains and bodies of people when they're doing these things.
You mean like an fMRI?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, originally technologies like that were reserved for medical uses. You've got something going on inside of you, you got in the MRI to have a look around and see what's happening from a medical perspective. But, you know, the last 20 years has, you know, all of a sudden we're putting athletes into fMRI. We're putting freestyle rappers into fMRI. We're putting, like, jazz improv musicians into fMRI and watching what happens inside their brains when they start to do their thing. And it's helped uncover some of the mechanisms that are behind these interesting abilities that show up when people really start to click and everything starts lining up. We now call that flow state. There's other names for it, obviously. But yeah, I mean, it was the convergence of my own interests with this growth and burgeoning of neuroscience. And then, yeah, a lot of what Csikszentmihalyi was talking about in terms of the lived experience. Like, he was a psychologist, right? He talked about what does it feel like when you're in flow? And that was a very useful thing, because before that was, you know, we had terms like the zone, right? I believed in it because I'd seen it. I'd felt it myself. I watch athletes display it all the time, but there was no science behind it. And there were not even words, frankly, to describe it, because if you've been in it, and I were to say, you know it, but you can't describe it. You ask an athlete sometime, what do you feel like? What was the secret today when you were just having this outrageous performance? And they would just say, I don't know, it just felt easy. Well, I'm an academic first. Mm-hmm. What can you do with that? Mm-hmm. There was no neuroscience behind it. We didn't even have the phenomenology to describe it. And that's where Csikszentmihalyi really did us a big service. He said, well, he went around the world and studied people at their best. He was not looking for flow. He was trying to uncover what happiness was all about and what are the sort of universal experiences behind happiness. And what he found along the way was flow, because that's how people describe it. When I'm at my best, it's like one thought is just flowing into the next. or when I'm moving, it's like one movement is just flowing seamlessly into the next. And that's where the term originated. And so that, so he said, you know, he figured out that when you're at your best, the same eight or nine things show up, no matter who you are. You don't have to be a super athlete. You don't have to be a super artist. It's, you could be an assembly line worker. When we are in that state, the same sorts of experiences show up for everybody. And that was really powerful. And then the neuroscience converged on it. And that's where it gets really cool for me, at least.
And to me, that's a difficult thing to do, to mesh this thing that's so hard to define, that's that is not a, it's not a concrete or a tangible thing, and then have to turn it into that in a sense, or to really discover it, even though we, it's already, it's been there, but then you have to discover it in order to either write about it, study it, or to, I guess, capture it and be able to share it.
Yeah, it was a real gift, because it allowed, it put in these, you know, eight or nine landmarks. So I'll give you an example. So when we're in flow, one of the sort of hallmark characteristics is that, you know, this sense of oneness or connection shows up. That's one of the things that Csikszentmihalyi talked about. Then flash forward into the 2000s, and when the experience of oneness or connection shows up and you have somebody's brain inside an fMRI watching what happens there, then it's like, okay, well, there's a mechanism under this. There's biology under this experience, right? So your default mode network starts to get really quiet. That's your sense of self. And when sense of self starts to evaporate, what emerges in its place? A sense of connection, right? So this is a part of the sort of the neuroscience helping to explain some of these, you know, characteristics or the lived experiences that we all have when we feel this way.
Yeah, there's a, I don't know if I shared this with you in our communications trying to book the podcast, but I read an excellent book about a year ago by Sally Jenkins. It's called The Right Call. And it's all about this, and it's highly recommended. She's a very highly regarded sports writer for the Washington Post, and her dad was a sports writer as well. And going back to earlier in the conversation, we talked about you growing up with the Gretzky's, and now it's the McDavid's. We're obviously using Canadian examples right now,
yeah, but
the Jordans as well when it comes to basketball. And she talks about the fact that there are high-functioning people in business, but we can't see them. We can see the results. We can see their share price. We can see the products that they put out. We can see those successes, the rockets that they launch or the iPhones that they make or whatever it may be. But she said with sports, what is so intriguing about it is we can watch these, what would be executives in the business world, performing at this high level. So when we see that, it makes it more importable to us as people who are interested in this type of thing. And she talks about exactly what we're talking about these systems, sometimes subconsciously, but sometimes deliberately, that these athletes have acquired stress-resistant learning, for example, and been able to turn into this spectacular, like, world-beating performance right in front of our eyes, which you can't see in a boardroom. And right. It's a fascinating book because of that.
I don't know the book. It sounds like it would be right up my alley.
Yep.
I've already written down the title here on my notepad, but yeah, I mean, there are the key point I think that you're making is that when we see people who are performing in front of our eyes on TV, and that could be an athlete, that could be an artist, it could be pick your artist, musician, whatever it is, we see it on display and it's, wow, these people are doing things that I cannot do. And they must be special, and there must be something different about the way that they operate. But then, you know, what you start to see in these ideas in the book that you just mentioned, you don't see it as obviously in the boardroom, right? Like, business results are, you know, share prices are sort of a lagging indicator of a high performer or high performing team, right? But they're doing something on the day to day that is special. And when you really study the lives of these people, you start to see the similarities between how they operate and how sort of the more famous typical sports or musicians operate, there's a lot of similarities there. But it's there for us too, right? I mean,
yeah,
these things, we experience them too, and we don't, I think, appreciate it. One of the great gifts of Csikszentmihalyi was showing that this is a universal phenomenon available to all of us.
He even talked about assembly line workers as yeah. well as high performance athletes.
And, exactly.
And which I think really makes it applicable to everybody.
Yeah.
And there was a definition in some of the research about flow. And I want to know if this is the way you see, I think this was written by Dr. Swan, if I remember right. Here's his definition of flow. My mind, and this is by what he did, is he interviewed a bunch of different athletes and high performers, and then he took all their answers and made this definition. My mind isn't wandering. I don't seem to hear anything. The world seems to be cut off from me. I am less aware of myself and my problems.
Yeah.
And this is how he described flow. The only thing he doesn't talk about there is time, because I think the perception of the passage of time is critical in this flow state as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I think what Swan was saying there is bang on. You know, there is this, you know, we talked a minute ago about this sort of loss of sense of self. That's definitely one of the characteristics, and this idea that we're really focused on what is in front of us, right? Whatever thing we're working on, you could pick your task. That could be the sport you're playing, the instrument you're playing, the work you're doing at your computer. All of the distractions just kind of melt away, and we get all of our attention, or at least the majority of our attention, is focused on the task at hand, right? We become locked into the present. And this relates to the point that you were making about time, because another one of those characteristics that Csikszentmihalyi wrote about extensively was this strange alteration in how we perceive time when flow shows up. So sometimes time goes by very quickly, right? Anytime you've had a great conversation with a friend and you look up and an hour zipped by or 2 hours have gone by and it felt like 5 minutes, that's a flow experience. No mistaking it. The opposite can happen. This happens a lot of times in really dangerous environments or when things are really ramped up, where time can open up. And this happened to me once in a car accident. I was going through an intersection, car was coming through, running a red light. I caught it out of the corner of my eye at the last second before impact. And I remember there must have been, I bet you, 300 milliseconds I had to react to this. And I remember thinking I had time for about 15 different decisions. I need to lean forward. It's going to hit right here. I need to move my head because I can see I'm spinning now in the car and a lamppost is over here. And I'm literally feeling like I'm in the Matrix. Those are examples of how time perception can be dramatically altered when we get into these states. And, you know, one of the way that this relates to the idea of being present is that, so the reason, I'll back up a touch, the reason that we have this perception of time the way that we do as human beings is because of our frontal lobes. Like, it's, the frontal lobes don't do all of the perceptual processing of time, but they're involved in a network that does. So we perceive time as human beings in a very specific way. Namely, we can think back, right? I can go back 5 years and remember what happened. I can remember what happened yesterday or earlier today. And I can use that information in helping me plan for the future. The human brain is great at this, right? My dog, who's sleeping next to me right now, does not have this ability. My dog seems to live in a world that's about 5 minutes long. If I go out of the room and I come back in, it's Christmas morning all over again. We can go beyond that. We can think back and we can plan ahead, because really what, you know, this skill was designed to do is help us survive, right? I can look outside and see that, you know, there's grass growing and some buds are showing up on a tree. That means spring's coming. That means I can make plans for what's, put some seeds in the ground. It's the good, those are survival skills, right? But they are not high performance skills, because your brain is basically designed to keep you alive, to pass on your genetic information.
Bottom line, that's what it's for.
That's it. It's not designed to, you know, help you climb a mountain without ropes. I mean, that's the dumbest thing,
or
that
make
your
a pass
brain
from behind the net with your back turned to it.
Yeah, or in your case, climbing up Mount Everest without oxygen. This is not what the brain wants you to do to keep mm-hmm. you alive. And so what happens in flow is that as your frontal lobe activity starts to decline, that's one of the things that happens. And we know from the neuroscience of flow, the frontal lobe activity starts to deactivate.
So tell me about that. Let's double tap on that.
Yeah.
So when you're looking in an fMRI, are you looking at a slice of the brain and it's lighting up because of electrical impulses? Is that how you see that it's functioning? How does one see that?
It depends on the imaging tool that you're using, but certainly you can look at electrical activity, you can look at blood flow, and you can see these different areas of the brain becoming either more active or less active. That's the kind of the simplest way to look at it. And one of the things that tends to happen in flow, the term for it is a bit mouthful, it's called selective transient hypofrontality, which just means selective parts of the frontal lobe are temporarily going offline. And if you think of your frontal lobes having its own function, but it also is part of a broader network of functioning. And one of those networks is our perception of time. So when the frontal lobes go out, the network starts acting weird and it doesn't function as it normally does. And no longer are we able to look back. No longer are we able to project forward. And without those two abilities at our disposal, what are we left with?
The
present moment. And so it's a really fascinating way of sort of thinking about things, like, you know, to be present is, it's a almost like a buzzword these days. And I find it fascinating that there's actually, and of course there is, a biological explanation for it. It's just kind of cool that we're able to look at that now.
I think your description of the running the red light thing, it's happened to me. It's what you described is exactly what happened to me. Several years ago, I ride my bike to work. I was riding home from work. A lady ran the red light. I was on my bike and she broadsided me. But for that millisecond, she was probably 5 meters away and I was making all these calculations in my head. I knew what was going to happen. I thought I was going to lose my left leg. I was going to, you know, it was just everything slowed down, which must be our primitive way of making decisions when we're being charged by a large predator, or when we're in the backcountry and an avalanche is rushing toward us, and it allows us to make the right decision, the right call, and anticipate what's going to happen. Is that your understanding of it?
Yeah, certainly it is. I mean, a lot of this is sort of logical speculation from how we would have evolved, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we needed a skill like flow when we were
being
chased
by
around by
or
things,
something,
right? Or when we were, you know, caught in bad weather, we were, you know, having to cross great distances. I mean, we needed this tool. It has been evolutionarily preserved, and it shows up when we sort of recreate these conditions of risk or consequence that we might call sport or performance or big meetings, whatever it has to be. So it's like we tap into this skill. And again, the cool part for me is just that we've been able to, you know, get in and understand the mechanisms that are at play under the surface so that we can, through some intelligent design, start to move ourselves towards this state that I think previously everyone just, and I think most people still to this day, assume is just a mystical experience that has no explanation. It only happens for who knows why when all the stars in the universe align. But now that we start to understand these mechanisms, like the aha moment is, oh, well, if your frontal lobes are shutting down when it's selectively, when we start to, you know, the case I gave of freestyle rappers, when a freestyle, they literally do these studies. Put a freestyle rapper into fMRI and watch what happens in their brain when they switch from reciting memorized lyrics, something they know by heart, to when they have to then all of a sudden start to freestyle. They're making it up. They're improvising. They get into flow. And all of a sudden you see these strange deactivations across the frontal lobe show up. That's amazing. Okay, so that's what happens. But we know of other ways that you can deactivate your frontal lobes on purpose. So there's a phenomenon called exercise-induced transient hypofrontality, which you, I'm sure, know very well. You get your body moving through space. You get your heart rate up to a certain level. Takes, you know, the latest we know about this is about 15 to 20 minutes of mild to moderate exercise will start to, you'll start to see those patterns of deactivation show up. More intense exercise, 3 to 5 minutes, the same thing starts to happen. So that's just one of the mechanisms that are at play here, but we know that we can induce that same thing using movement as an example.
So on your comment or on movement and exercise, is there an increased efficacy if you're moving outdoors and we're getting what we call forward ambulation, where you're using your peripheral vision, you're anticipating, you know, the dog walker coming towards you or a car coming at an intersection? Is that a value added?
Yeah, it is. And it's for a bunch of different reasons. So I'll give you one. So if you are, you know, let's say you've just been working for 2 hours straight and your mind and your frontal lobes in this case are highly active, right? You've just been doing a heavy bout of work and you go out and you want to go for a walk. Okay. So let's say that you walk on a treadmill or you go outside and walk. Let's talk about the differences there. One of the things that happens when we actually do have that forward ambulation through 3D space is this. There's another phenomenon that I don't want to confuse with flow state, but it's called optic flow. Exactly. This is okay, the world moving by you, like your optics, the world is moving past you. That actually induces a bit of a relaxation response. It calms down your autonomic nervous system and we start to relax more. That does not happen when you're on a treadmill. You get the cardiovascular benefits, but you won't get that relaxation benefit of what just happens automatically when we're moving through space. Okay, that's part of it. The other part is just being outdoors, especially in big, beautiful, wild environments. Now you're adding in these things that, you know, in my world, we call flow triggers, where novelty is a huge flow trigger, doing something new that you haven't experienced before. That is a flow trigger. If there's a bit of risk, you're out in the woods, maybe there's a cougar walking around, maybe there's a bear walking around in there, right? You're more heightened. Your concentration levels on the environment around you go up. You become more present in that moment, right? So there's all sorts of benefits to it, I think, to, you know, moving your body, but also moving your body outdoors and best case scenarios in big, wild, natural environments.
So I think now we understand through your examples here what flow is. And it reminds me of the Supreme Court in the U.S., I think in the 60s, was trying to define hardcore pornography. And one of the justices said, I can't define it, but I know what it is when I see it. And I think that's a lot like flow, right? You can't write it down and describe it, but he goes, but I know what it is when I see it. And I think that's a really good description of being in flow.
It is. And that's absolutely true. We know when we're there, even if we don't have the words to describe it. Luckily, you know, we do in the background starting to have a bit better understanding of it. But yeah,
that's funny enough. Csik Mihaly talked about entering a flow state during sex, too. That was one of his examples. Really interesting.
Absolutely. Oh, I mean, the thing that he pointed out, I think really correctly, is that, you know, flow isn't just one thing, right? I think when we think about flow, we think about the peak experiences of life, and those are, and we would call those, well, Csikszentmihalyi and Abraham Maslow, they talked about peak experiences, these transcendent moments where we transcend our sense of self, to get back to our earlier conversation. And those peak experiences, like sex, like going to a Taylor Swift concert, like they all have this, all the mechanisms are just working and the volume knob is cranked at 12, right? But there are beneath that levels of flow that he would call micro flow experiences, where, you know, maybe it's not the most powerful and transforming event of your life, but some of these characteristics, like time passing strangely, a high degree of focus, this sense of connection, can show up in more subtle ways. And I think that's those are the types of experiences that I think are undervalued, and there's great power in those micro flow experiences too. And so, you know, I just don't want to lose sight of that, although, you know, the peak experiences are pretty great.
So you're, like when we opened up with you, you focus on learning and stress-resistant learning. How does flow combine with that, or how does flow impact learning, and then more importantly, learning in high-stakes environments? Let's say like aviation, special forces, police, paramedics, whatever? How does that?
Yeah,
what's the relationship there?
Well, there's a few, but I think one of the things to know about learning is that anytime we, if I asked you right now, Labelle, what is your most potent memory of your life? Or give me a couple of them, like top of your head, what are your most powerful memories?
Well, non-powerful memories would be losing our son, right? For sure. That's the one that always leads to mind.
Yeah.
The birth of a child.
Yeah.
I have been in situations of intense flow, and I shared this with you in an email where, you know, I'm flying a 737 and it feels like the airplane is part of me. It literally feels like, you know, 150,000 pounds of steel with all the doors intact is part of me. And it feels like I can anticipate what's going to happen. And I'm listening to air traffic control on the radio and I know exactly what's going to be said. And the airplane just becomes part of me, this man-machine interface. So for me, those are some examples of powerful moments.
And, you know, I'm going to go back to the first two because they're sort of opposite ends of the same spectrum. You've got the birth of a child and the tragic loss of a child. Mm-hmm. Those two, I mean, if you think about those two experiences, the thing that they have in common is this incredible emotional experience you are having in both of those conditions. The opposite ends of the spectrum again. But the point is that when experience is tied with emotion, that is what really consolidates vivid memories, right? So, you know, if we think about what flow experiences are, they are highly emotional experiences. When we are having the best day ever, there's an emotional component to that. Like the things that are associated with flow are blissful feelings, effortlessness, high concentration. A lot of times that, and there's a ton of reward and dopamine that are part of those experiences. And the more of those chemicals that are underneath the experience, the more those neural connections form in your brain that ultimately lead to memory. So if you are doing high flow activities on a regular basis, there's a really good chance, and the case has been made for this. There's a great book that I often refer people to. It's called The Rise of Superman by Stephen Kotler. And he talks a lot about the phenomenon that is going on and still going on in the world of so-called extreme sports, right? I work with a bunch of crazy snowboarders. You know, the kinds of things that are going to win gold medals in 2 years in Italy will be off the charts compared to what they were at the last Olympics. And that was true of the, you know, the years before that. It's going up at an exponential rate. Whereas if you look at other sports, you can make the case that there's steady progression, but it's more incremental, right? Like things don't change that much. Like every once in a while, there are generational talents that we've spoken. They come along and they blow things apart. But this is every day in sports like snowboard and skateboard and BMX and all the rest of it, right? Part of the thesis there is that these people are doing such highly emotionally charged experiences so frequently, and that is what's driving this elevated learning or progression that you see happening there. That's the thesis, and there's some pretty good evidence for it too. So that in a nutshell is the relationship, at least the way I see it, between flow experiences and learning. It's really the emotional driver. You have an experience that is highlighted by all these powerful emotional neurochemicals. Those are the memories that go in the deepest. So those can be positive experiences. Those can be negative, traumatic experiences. But if we're talking about the world of skill development, then we're talking about the memory of the movement and the things that we're trying to get better at.
That's really interesting. It's like in order to grow in those scenarios, to get better at big air, for example, competitions in snowboarding or gymnastics or that type of thing, where you've got that real important connection between movement and gravity and velocity, that you need to fertilize that with the chemicals and that come from the high emotional experience. And with
that's great. I've never heard it called a fertilizer before, but that's exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm going to borrow that from you.
Take it. It's all yours. Take credit for it. One thing that I notice when, and it's happened to me too, when we are training pilots, training airline pilots, when you give them some emergencies, so a fire, an engine coming apart, loss of control of the aircraft because of a malfunction, they will start to, let me step back. We have, in the airplane, we have multiple electrical systems that power the airplane. So generally we have three. And when one generator, we'll call it, fails, the airplane starts to automatically offload systems that it doesn't think are important to you to continue the flight. It offloads superfluous vestigial systems that you don't need anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like when I've been in the back of the sim and I'm watching two pilots, I can see them miss warning lights, caution lights, but especially sound. Warning horns, beeps, certain things that tell you that something's either been disengaged, is failing, is on fire. They will quite often lose their hearing in high workload, high stress environments.
Yeah,
it's fascinating. Is that the prefrontal cortex being offloaded, like the electrical system on an airliner?
I think so. I mean, I'm going to venture into the bit of speculation here, but here's what I do know to be true. That, I forget what the exact percentage of it is, but the vast majority of your brain is responsible for the processing of visual information. We are visually dominant creatures, right? And lesser parts of the brain are there processing sound and touch and taste and smell. And so I think when things get extreme and things get intense, yeah, we're going to just default. We only have so much processing space and we only have so much bandwidth to be noticing what's happening around us. It seems very much like the default setting is to
load shed.
Yes. And this is true. I mean, you can, for example, your system of proprioception, your internal sense of what's happening, like if you're flying a plane and you feel movements proprioceptively you can do this with your eyes closed, obviously, mm-hmm. And the better you get at things, the better you're able to tune into those. And they're really, really super accurate systems. But we default to vision. Like if you've ever been sitting at a stoplight and somebody pulls up next to you and is driving a standard transmission and they take their foot off the clutch and they roll back a little bit.
Yep.
What do? You jam on the brake because there's two systems competing here. One is your visual system and it's saying, it should know that you're not moving. And your proprioceptive system, which would sense if you were actually moving forward or backwards, is not detecting anything. But the visual system and your peripheral vision there, seeing that car roll back, we just respond to the visual stimuli.
Takes precedence.
100%. So, yeah. I mean, so that's part of, I think, what's going on there.
So we're talking about learning. We're talking about stress-resistant learning and learning in high-stakes environments.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, let's talk about this optimal challenge point because a lot of the stuff that I've seen in your writing talks about, and this is back when you were heavily involved in golf as well,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is a sport, I think, which I don't golf, but I think it is so ideal because everybody I speak to who golfs has a serious passion for it and a hate for it at the same time because it's so difficult.
Yeah.
Right. And so much of it is upstairs. So
sure.
You talk about optimal challenge point in learning. Talk about that.
Sure.
Describe that to us.
Yeah, this was a framework that was actually originally written by my master supervisor. His name's Mark Guadagnoli and one of our fellow colleagues, a gentleman named Tim Lee. And they wrote about this idea. This was back in the early, mid 2000s. And the idea there is that we learn, like if you look at what a learning curve looks like, and let's say you plotted how well you're doing in a practice setting versus how well you do when the pressure shows up. That's where learning really is defined and measured and observed. Can you do it at some point in the future? And what happens is, if you look, so we'll go to golf as an example. Thank you for bringing golf up. I'll defend golf here. If you watch somebody who's just starting to play, and you say, okay, we're going to let you practice for a while. And, you know, what happens, it tends to be as you practice, your performance during the practice starts to go up, especially if you're doing the same things repeatedly. You start to show signs of improvement, right? But the problem is, if you bring people back the next day and you test them and you look for real signs of learning, because learning actually happens later. You don't actually learn in the here and now. Learning happens when we're asleep, by and large. So you have to bring people back to really assess learning. And what you see is that as you progressively challenge people more, so you get them to practice more difficult things or under more difficult situations, their performance during the practice starts to struggle a little bit, right? Because it's not easy anymore. But what happens when they come back and you assess them on learning, they've learned more. And there's this really interesting disconnect between what you see happening in front of you in the here and now and how much learning is actually going on. There's a deceptive relationship. We call this the learning performance paradox. So what you see happening in front of you does not necessarily indicate how much real learning is going on. And the thing about challenge point that ties this together is there's this sweet spot where you need to challenge people in the learning environment just enough so that you'll see failures happen there. You have to design for that, because if all you're designing for is perfect practice, you're not going to see the returns show up in learning. So this is why simulators are so good for this sort of thing, for pilots, because it's not perfect. There are struggles. You're emotionally engaged in the process to some degree. And you won't see perfection there, but what you will see is elevated rates of learning compared to somebody who's just phoning it in during the training. And of course, there's a tipping point there too. It can be too difficult, and now we're not learning either. But finding that sweet spot of where the challenge level is just right relative to how difficult that task is, that's where you see the biggest return on the learning side of things.
And right at the beginning of the conversation, we were talking about learning, and one of the words you said was the history of the individual.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not treating everybody like they're a Homo sapiens sapien, and they're all the same. So when you in your mental performance coaching environment, are you doing an interview with people? Are you talking to them about their past? Are you trying to get an idea? And will that help if, for example, we're talking about challenge point, will that help in setting the optimal point because of their history?
For sure. I mean, when you say history, if we're talking about athletes here, we're really talking about their skill level. So most of the athletes that I work with tend to be at the higher skill level. So a lot of my athletes are professional and rather elite there. So this is how it works. Here's a really simple way to think about this. So if you're first beginning a new skill, so pick a skill, right? Let's say you're going to go
golf.
You're going to go play some golf. So Laval, you're going out to the range. How are you going to practice today? And in the motor learning world, there are some terms like blocked practice and randomized practice. So for you as a beginner or someone who doesn't play a lot, what happens is if you do the same thing repeatedly, we call that block practice. You grab a 7-iron, you hit it 100 times, right? That is probably optimal for you challenge-wise. Doing the same thing over and over again. And that's what research shows. If you do block, and that could be compared to getting somebody who's exactly like you in terms of skill level and making them, say, grab a new club every time they take a swing or pick a different target where you're randomizing everything. That becomes more difficult. For beginners, by and large, and this is a generalization, but this is what the research support, block practice tends to be the way to get better faster for a beginner. But then at the other end of the spectrum, what you see is that the people, as you get better, you need more variability. You need more randomness. And this is a challenge for people, because I can tell you what, if I go out on the range at a PGA Tour event, And I watch people practice. You see a lot of elite players doing this blocked practice, doing the same shot over and over and over again in service of what? Getting better? That is not what the research support. They need to be challenging themselves more during their practice session if they want to see the returns show up in a learning environment. And it all has to do with what we talked about earlier, by the way. When things get difficult, we tend to get more focused. We tend to feel a bit of agitation. There's a neurochemical experience going on inside of us that leads to deeper encoding. So for the beginner, that happens when you're just trying to repeat a movement over and over and over again. But that doesn't work for somebody who's really, really good at something. You have to induce some agitation in the system through some other mechanism. And the way you practice is just a really simple way of thinking about that.
And this is not psychology. Like, you don't, like, I mean, yeah. It seems like it's a real mesh. Like,
sure. Yeah. And I mean, look, this is where, so that stuff on blocked and random practice, that's what we do in the research lab. But when I'm out actually with an athlete and I see that they are in a practice session, in a training session, they're in the challenge, they're in the struggle. This is where psychology really has to become an important piece of this, because you can't just say, keep at it.
Yeah.
You know, keep at it. This is what we're after. No, because maybe you had a bad sleep last night. Maybe you've kind of hurt something. Maybe you're afraid. Like in big air snowboard, there are really important things to be afraid of out there. It is scary and dangerous. So this is where, yes, the ways of training matter. But if you are ignoring the fact that that person doing those different types of training methods have a mind and have a psychology that is real for them in that moment, you're just missing a really important variable.
So take me to that snowboarder doing big air. Now, mm-hmm. Are you dealing with them in a clinical environment? Are you actually out on the slope with them and they're about to kick off and try and do a triple front flip 10 meters above the ground? And is that when you're dealing with them, or is it a combination of things?
It's both. Well, first of all, I would never call it clinical because I'm not a clinician in that.
Okay.
Regard. Yep. So that I reserve that for the clinical psychologist.
An office environment. Then we'll
in an office environment, it usually goes down in a coffee shop or in the gym before snow, after snow. So yes, we do have off snow sessions where we talk about what are the things you can do to prepare yourself. This includes, again, all the conversations around sleep, around how you're fueling, but also around some actual mental performance skills, like increasing self-awareness, increasing the ability to regulate your nervous system under times of stress or times of low stress. Like, we need to get up for moments too. High performance isn't about being relaxed all the time.
Okay, how do you do that? That's an easy thing to say, but how do we?
Sure.
How do we increase? Are we talking about breathing techniques? Are we talking about visual? Like, what are we doing?
So now we're talking, the challenge here is usually in the training environment, because if you're in the contest or competitive environment, you're there, you're engaged. The moment is bringing that level of arousal for you. Sometimes it's too high, but when you're in a training environment, a lot of times, you know, it's a Monday, it's cold outside, and, you know, we're in the dark on a glacier in the Yukon or something, right? In those moments, you might not feel really motivated to send some huge trick that you've never done before. Maybe no human being has ever done before. So what can you do? This is where, you know, what we're really talking about are ways of elevating your nervous system stimulation. So you want to increase arousal. You want to increase attention. And there are things you can do and practices that you can do that can help you get better at this. You named a couple. Breathing, according to certain patterns, can either increase your autonomic system arousal or decrease it. So simplest way to think about this, if you accentuate your inhale, so if you inhale for a longer period than when you exhale, you're going to see your heart rate go up. You're going to see your blood pressure go up. Your sympathetic nervous system is becoming stimulated. If you reverse that, if you extend your exhale relative to your inhale, so if you have a 4-second inhale and an 8-second exhale, that is going to stimulate your parasympathetic nervous system, which brings the heart rate down, which brings blood pressure down, and starts to relax your system. So breath is a really quick and easy way to turn that dial in either direction. Now, those are sort of behavioral practices. You can do things in the environment itself. Like we talked about, like having variability in how you practice something. If you're really good and you add variability, what you're doing is adding challenge, and challenge changes your internal world too, right? That'll start to stimulate your nervous system because what you're doing is difficult. And if it gets too difficult or too challenging or too scary, then we have to turn the dial the other way and try to find that sweet spot where we feel like, okay, I'm energized, I'm here, I'm ready, but I feel like it is in a manageable dose. So it's all about trying to control this, you know, the basic autonomic nervous system arousal levels, and there's numerous ways to do that.
So you as a academic, and you're about to write a paper.
Yeah.
And you're probably like all of us that I think we all dread sitting down and writing sometimes, especially when it could be dry at times.
Yeah.
Because of the way it has to be delivered.
Yeah.
How do you get yourself prepped for that?
Yeah, you're talking about the ultimate, for me at least, the ultimate need for upregulation of my nervous system when I have to sit down and write. So I have to write. It's part of my job as an academic and other things. Like I have to write things. And writing has always been like kryptonite for me. I don't love the process of it. I find it very challenging, and I procrastinate on writing more than anything else in my life. And so for me, these are like the moments where I have to rise up to it. And I used to only largely rely on a deadline, because what does a deadline present for you? Risk, consequence, starts to change your internal chemistry, gets you focused. So that's what I used to use. When I was going through school, I used this way too much. But then as I started to learn more about these things and how we can alter our level of focus, our level of arousal through certain practices, I've completely revamped it. So, you know, one of the things I will do I might actually be jumping into one of these as we speak, but if I get a new writing project, the first thing I will do is be really intentional about how I set up my first week or so of writing sessions. That means it goes into the calendar, and I'm going to give myself, usually on day one, literally this is what I do. I will sit down and I'll say from between 9 and 10 a.m., I am going to write 250 words. That is nothing, right? That is a paragraph. If you're a really good writer, that is embarrassing. But I know for me, that gets me close to that optimal challenge point, because I know I'm going to grind over every one of those 250 words. But I've given myself an hour. I've given myself a word count goal. Clear goals are like one of the most overlooked but important flow triggers. If I know where I'm going and I know what I'm trying to do, doesn't mean I'm going to find flow, but I'm at least directionally aligned to what it is I'm trying to do. Get rid of uncertainty. Get clear on what you're trying to do.
Focused work.
It does. So like that's a big part of it. But I also, frankly, I will sit down. I will do some upregulatory breath work before I sit down to write. I usually front end those writing sessions with a walk for 20 minutes, so I know I can get my frontal lobes a little bit quiet down that inner critic a little bit, not be thinking about the future deadline, right? Helps me get a little bit locked in the present. So there's all sorts of things I do. And, you know, I think that's a good example that I think a lot of people can relate to. Wherever you feel like that thing that you don't love doing, but it's important that you do, there are strategies you can use and implement to help you navigate that resistance, that struggle to get started, right? Move so follows action is a great expression. I think Brad Stolberg, I think, is the one that coined it. But sometimes you just have to get into it and get into it in a more intentional and smart way, so that once the work starts happening, you have some chance of finding flow on the other side.
It's almost aggression. You have to be aggressive at completing that task, that 250 words, and be completely focused on it.
Sure. Yeah. Like you can go into it and go like, I got this. And you can be like, take an aggressive posture to it. That can be another way of looking at it. Like, I'm going to, like, if aggression to me means, yeah, this is going to be hard, but I'm going to attack it. Like, mm-hmm. I can do this. This is sort of like where mindset starts to come into the conversation. And think about this in the Carol Dweck way of mindset. Like, the growth mindset means, hey, obstacles are just the thing you have to overcome on the way to success. I accept that going in.
That's so important, because Csikszentmihalyi talked about that as well. And I think resilience is part of this as well, but we are all going to be faced with challenges. We're going to be faced with tragedies. We're going to be faced with all kinds of calamities in our life, but we have mm-hmm. to take every one of those. This is not my quote, it's his quote. And we basically have to take something. We have to embrace the challenge, and we have to see these challenges as something that, even though at the time they may not be positive, is something that we can get something from.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important.
It is. And, you know, that's, again, this is sort of in the psychology realm, but undoubtedly going into challenging things with the mindset that, okay, look, I know this is going to be hard, but I know that through hard things is where, you know, getting out of the comfort zone, describe it however you want, that is where the goodness lies on the other side of that. That's a big part of it. And then also accepting that even if I fail here, I will be better for having tried. Like, that's the essence of a growth mindset. And on the front end of anything hard, it's a really important checkpoint to remind yourself of. And then the cool thing is when you actually do the hard thing, and if you keep doing hard things, you can get better at doing hard things. One of the coolest parts of this is, again, I'll dip into the neuroscience a little bit, but there's a part of your brain called the anterior mid cingulate cortex, and it gets bigger in people who consistently work on hard things. For example, it's quite small in people who are obese, and it grows in size when they take on some sort of a diet or something that's designed to that's a challenge for them. This part of the brain starts to grow. It also starts to grow, and you see correlations between academic achievement, in work outcomes, in health outcomes, as this part of the brain gets bigger. So this idea of, like, intentionally putting yourself in difficult situations, going into it with a healthy mindset, finding something that looks like an optimal challenge point, these are skills. And what I mean by that is you can get better at them over time. And how that shows up in the brain is this brain area that's super critical for tenacity, grit, whatever you want to call it, actually gets bigger.
And right now, there's sort of this, we're at this cultural inflection point where anxiety is this ultra common pathology that we see everywhere. And when you and I grew up, we were anxious before an exam. We were anxious walking across the dance floor to talk to a girl. We were anxious about getting a job or paying our bills, but we didn't even, that's as far as it went.
Mm-hmm.
But now it seems like it's this very common pathology that you see everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, I think all of the data would support what you're saying there. The rates of anxiety, the rates of depression, the rates of a whole host of mental health problems.
What's your hypothesis? Is it because of this?
I feel like, yeah. So I think it's part of the access to technology. I think a lot of it, you know, how we feel in the world, there's a really interesting relationship between doing hard things and getting this internal reward for doing hard things. So when, like, you're a great example of this. All you ever do is hard physical things. You lean into this as a lifestyle, right? And you have found a way to attach your dopamine reward system to those things. So hard work for you is connected with reward. A lot of our technologies are just giving the reward piece, and all we have to do is scroll. So there's this disconnection between having
brilliant
to work
way to
for
describe
anything
it.
And the reward. So you can just sit there and be passively rewarded. And so when
dopamine hit after dopamine hit after dopamine hit.
Exactly. So now when you look at the world around you and you don't see any immediate rewards just coming your way, you get these big drops in baseline dopamine. And so you walk around the world feeling unmotivated, feeling more stressed out about the daunting prospect of having to engage in things that you're uncomfortable with. That leads to anxiety. I'm not a psychologist. Mm-hmm. I look inside the brain and I look at what's happening around this. I think, and there's some pretty good evidence to support what I'm saying here. I think as a sort of take-home message here, the more you can lean in to doing hard things intentionally, like choosing to do it. It doesn't have to be climbing Mount Everest in your case. This could be a lot of the athletes I work with. I get them to train against stress just by getting in cold water and regulating how they respond to the anxiety in those moments. If you can get used to it there, suddenly, you know, doing hard things in everyday life don't seem quite as difficult. So the more you can do this and the more you can attach a reward, i.e. the dopamine system, to work, I think the better off you're going to be from a mental health standpoint.
Yeah, and your description of it is so apt, and I feel that exactly. I mean, my slogan on my website is step out, shove off. And stepping out means, the way I describe it, is that you're in your tent at high altitude. It's minus 30 outside. The tent is warm inside from the sun. You've got your sleeping bag, your Nalgene bottle, your food, your fuel. And to unzip that tent and step out is really, really difficult because you're comfortable and you leave that 2 millimeters of Gore-Tex or nylon that's protecting you.
Yeah.
And now you're totally exposed. But I can tell you that when you do step out of this, of these comfort zones, and I don't want to use a bromide, but you step out of your comfort zone, you always, always return after a challenge like that feeling so much better.
Yeah. Because you know that, and through experience, you can anticipate that it's going to happen. And you can also anticipate that the part of your brain that does that work for you is getting bigger, as evidence that this skill is being more ingrained. And you're more conscious about connecting these hard moments to either the anticipation of reward or reward itself. I'll tell you about some kind of cool research that I think really highlights the point you're making. They've done research. This is actually Andrew Huberman's research. I know he's famous for podcasting these days, but he's also a scientist and works on some pretty cool projects in his lab. And one of the projects he worked on involved having mice in a cage. And what they would do, try to scare these mice, is they'd hover an owl, like a stuffed owl, over top of the cage. This would induce stress response. So at a big, powerful adrenaline dump, that is what stress is. And when that happens, mice, just like human beings, will do one of three things sort of unconsciously. It's either fight, flight, or freeze. It's what we all do in the face of a stressor. And what happened was fascinating. So they were tracking, you know, dopamine and adrenaline centers in the brain when all this was going on. So most of the time when you hover a predator over a mouse, what they do is freeze up. And when they freeze up, you see a lot of adrenaline being released. When sometimes they'll scurry away and try to hide in the corner. Again, what you see there is adrenaline. However, interestingly, and for reasons unknown, every once in a while, one of these mouse gets up and starts bashing its tail against the cage. And this is the mouse's version of, like, bring it on. When they do that, yes, they get the big adrenaline dump, but they also get dopamine. So it's like our brains are designed to reward us for leaning into hard things. That's the mechanism we're talking about here. That's you saying, I'm going to unzip my sleeping bag and I'm going to take a step. That's you rattling your tail and going, bring it on. And you get reward for that. And again, the more you do that, the better you get at it and the more rewarding it gets over time.
Brilliant. As we're sort of getting to the end here, Chris, you talked about in one podcast or something that you wrote, maybe it was a podcast, you talked about managing doubt and paralysis by analysis, which I think go hand in hand, in that people can spend so much time analyzing, unzipping that tent fly, or learning a new language or writing a paper or stepping up on stage to do a speaking mm-hmm. gig. And I've been in all these scenarios other than the golf thing. So talk about that. Talk about managing doubt and paralysis by analysis, which, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems that they go hand in hand.
Yeah, they do. I think as it pertains to doubt, I think there's some interesting things to talk about here. So doubt really shows up when you get this voice inside your head saying, why are you doing this? This is dangerous. This is dumb. This is not in service of evolution, right? And that part of your brain, that inner critic, you can actually measure it. So if I were to put you into an MRI right now, Laval, and say, tell me about a time where you really screwed up and you really made some bad decisions in your life or on a given day. When you tell yourself this story, there's a part of your frontal lobe that gets very, very active. That is the seat of doubt. Now, the interesting thing that happens as we move towards these better states of performance like flow is that same brain area gets very, very quiet. That's one of the areas that is selectively deactivated once we start moving into these more optimal states of consciousness. It's again the same mechanism that gets quieter when you go out for a walk for 15.
Is this the transient hypofrontality?
Yes. So this is one of the areas of your frontal lobe region that starts to deactivate when we engage in exercise or other things. So to me, doubt again is one of these parts of your brain that is designed to help you be safe. That's why it shows up. Doesn't want you to take a risk, doesn't want you to hurt yourself, doesn't want you to take a social risk and be ostracized from your tribe. It's trying to keep you alive. Now, when that serves us well, a lot of times, but when we are trying to move forward in a task and we're really trying to get better at something and we're really trying to move beyond that, that's where some of these strategies around, I'm going to go into this with the proper mindset. I might have to try to breathe my way through some of it. I'm going to take action anyways. I'm going to take a step towards that. All of these things can help you quiet down this brain activity that shows up as doubt. So again, it's sort of the same story. It's understanding what the mechanism is that causes doubt, understanding that there are things you can do to, in this case, deactivate that mechanism. And what shows up is confidence as an emergent property of this, not something you plan for. I always think of confidence as something that shows up when you get rid of other things. Then you're in the moment. You're free of self-doubt. You're not worried about the future. You're not concerned about past failures. You're just in it now. What that feels like in the moment, to me, is confidence.
So in this scenario where we're talking about doubt, I guess it depends what the doubt, what you're doubting, what the next action is going to be. Are we going to try and do an upregulation or downregulation to address this?
It depends. This is where the skill of self-awareness becomes so powerful. It is one of these meta skills that just serves so many different purposes. But if you can, in a moment, understand where you're at, I'm talking mentally, I'm talking from an attention standpoint, I'm talking physically. Can you tell if your heart is racing and your palms are sweaty? And then to say, from here, know where your optimal is, then you can practice becoming aware of what optimal feels like too. Then it's saying, okay, I'm here now. I know where I want to be. Do I have the tools to move mind and body towards this more optimal place? And sometimes that means turning the dial up. And sometimes it means turning the dial down. But it's based on this fundamental skill of, do you know where you're at?
It is situational awareness.
It's situational awareness. Yeah. It's internal awareness. It's all of it. Can you understand? Are you good at detecting the signals coming from mind and body? And then knowing if you're not where you want to be, learning the tools to help you steer towards that direction.
So as we wrap up here, Chris, now I don't want to be this typical podcast where, okay, here are the three things that you need to do to make it all better. But if it just to leave us with two things, whatever you want, 10 things about what we can take away as listeners to this interview. And Actually, maybe before you do that, hold that thought. What were the two breathing techniques for upregulation and downregulation? It was long inhale, shorter exhale, or vice versa for upregulation.
Yeah, just know this part. Every time you inhale, okay, your heart rate goes up.
Okay.
Measurably, every single time. Every time you exhale, your heart rate goes down, predictably, measurably. If you wear any kind of like tracking device up for heart rate, you can check this. So anytime the inhale is accentuated, your heart's going up for a longer period of time. That's raising heart rates, raising blood pressure, and it's raising baseline levels of alertness. The opposite is true when you accentuate the exhale. So yes, there are box breathing techniques, 4-7-8 breathing, all sorts of different types of breath work, but they all largely are centered around this idea of if you want to upregulate and increase arousal, accentuate the inhales. Gotcha. If you want to relax and downregulate, accentuate the exhales.
So I practiced this. I had a speaking gig in Edmonton the other day, and even though I've done hundreds of speaking gigs, you still get those butterflies
for sure.
Stage fright type of thing. You know, you peek out behind the curtain, there's 300 people sitting there and they're paid money to see me. And of course, yeah, I've got imposter syndrome going, what the hell are they doing here? So I actually went into the washroom in this hotel lobby and did this technique, and I did the upregulation. So I did the longer inhales and I talked to Janet after. She always asked me, she goes, how was that gig? And I said it was really good, and I used some of the breathing techniques that I've heard Chris talk about. And
yeah,
I thought, you know, maybe it's not a placebo effect, but maybe it's psychosomatic. But I really thought I just felt more locked and loaded and on my game.
That's fascinating. I feel you on this. I still feel it too. And you start to recognize it, and hopefully you learn to channel it, because you need that energy, right?
Yeah.
It's giving you the fuel. You just don't want it to get the better of you. And I think one of the things that you're talking about there is, regardless of even how you breathe, just being conscious about your breath, like moving your attention and awareness to your breath. If you really just pay attention to your breath, regardless of how you're breathing, what it's doing is it's taking your attention away from these other things like, oh my God, there's people out there, or oh my God, what ifs, right? If you can focus just on your breath and put your attention there, it squeezes out bandwidth for all these other things that you might be worrying about. So this is more in the mindfulness category, but it works too.
It does. Yeah. I'm happy I heard you say that on a podcast, because I thought I got a positive impact from it, and
good.
Hopefully the crowd did too.
I'm sure they did.
So back to the lead up. What are, if you're talking to yourself, your 18-year-old self, looking back now, what would, and knowing what you know now, what would you recommend in this vein, in what we're talking about? Because this touches on everything. This touches on your performance in the family, at work, in your physical environment, in your sports, and etc. So what are the 18-year-old Chris Bertram talking to you now?
Yeah, I think what I would say, it gets back to the idea of this self-awareness piece. You know, I think, you know, we get into, especially if it's the 18-year-old me, you start to get kind of set in your belief systems at that point, and stop being curious about things, and you stop being curious about yourself too. You're just like, this is me. This is what I am. This is how I operate. This is how I behave. Like, let's just press rewind and repeat every day. I think as I got a little bit older, and especially in more recent years where I've gotten more intentional about the practice of building self-awareness, you can do that a lot of ways, right? You can journal. You can take up a mindfulness practice where you start to really pay attention to how you react to things in the world and what that feels like on the inside. I feel like that has probably been the most powerful, I would call it another meta skill, right? That helps me navigate my own life in the best possible way so that I can show up when I'm giving a talk and put my best foot forward. But I also have found that when it comes to working with really high performers, that it is the tool that probably can help them the most, right? Knowing and being aware of how certain stimuli affect you before the knee-jerk response kicks in, right? So that's probably it. I would say to constantly be curious about yourself and constantly be working on it, being more sensitive to those internal signals and just sort of learning how you operate in the world. I think that's been my most powerful lesson that I've picked up over the last couple of decades.
I've heard this recently, and I've mentioned on a couple of podcasts that aging is the aggressive pursuit of comfort. And I think what we've learned here is that that the only way to function at a higher level in your life, anywhere in your life, is to challenge yourself and do hard things, do things that push you.
100%. Yes. Because, you know, I love that expression, by the way. It's another one I'm going to steal from you. Yeah, we get set in our ways. We get, you know, our ability to be curious and to push ourselves does definitely, for most people, taper with age. It's not, it doesn't mean that they're lost. It doesn't mean that you can't do it, but it has to become a more intentional practice. We're young, we're dumb, we take chances. We don't listen to the inner critic as much, right? But then it starts as we get into our mid-20s and beyond. Those things, those ways of moving forward and those ways of growing have to become more intentional. So the more you can lean into those things, the more you can create habits, lifestyles around these principles, I think the better off we're all going to be as we get on in a few years. Yeah.
Yeah. And when you get to a certain age, I mean, guys only grow up by the time they hit 40. Women are probably adults by the time they're 25. But when you hit a certain age, you know what a good day is. You know what it feels like to lay down in your bed at the end of the day and go, that was a good day. It's not a secret to us because we all know what it is.
Yeah.
And to me, a good day for me means that I've accomplished some things, but I've also challenged myself in some way. And what's so frustrating about it is when you see people that are not intentionally living their life that way. They know every morning what a good day is going to feel like at the end of the day. And I think we just get swept away by the current and just let things happen without actually, like you said, trying to direct yourself more intentionally and through self-awareness, through challenge, et cetera, et cetera.
That's exactly it. You just nailed it. I mean, it's challenging yourself. It's, you know, getting up and trying to find some meaning and purpose, go beyond that too. But those are the things, right? If you can connect to things that you're passionate about, that you find meaningful, that give your life more purpose, and then you get up and you take on some challenge every day. Yes, we get into bed at night and we feel like we won the day to some extent, yeah, right?
Won the day. That's good.
And then you know what? That's going to help us sleep. And that's going to help us show up the next day even better.
What does the future hold for you, Chris? I want to ask you about Exos, and then you foreshadowed the fact that you are about to write something. Are we talking about a book, or is this top secret? Are we talking about another paper? Or?
Yeah, well, if I say it here, then I guess I have to hold myself accountable. Yes, I've resisted the idea of writing a book. I've flirted with it a couple of times in my life, but I think I have what sort of feels to me for the first time like a real contribution I could make. It's very much connected to a lot of the ideas we've talked about here. So that's still in its infancy stage. But outside of that, yeah, I mean, I continue to enjoy the work that I'm doing at the university. I continue to enjoy working one-on-one with people who are pushing themselves to their absolute limits. I love doing that. And that's true with the athletes that I work with privately, but also within Exos, where we have a big stable of professional athletes that come to us, but also an even bigger group of what we could call corporate athletes, people in the corporate side of things that are looking to get more out of themselves. That's where I'm focused right now, and just the constant pursuit of how to do this stuff better and to try to figure out what science is telling us, then how to apply that science in ways that are actionable and things that people can use and help them get through the day a little bit better.
Sounds like the ideal job to me. Sounds like you're having fun.
I'm having a lot of fun. Yes, I am. Sounds like you are too. So I guess that's why we have such good conversations.
Yeah, exactly. So Chris, thanks for joining the podcast. You're going to have to beat your little mouse tail for every 250 word chunk of writing you're going to have to do to complete that book. Yes. Yeah, so keep us updated. We'd love to have you on again. If there's anything you ever want to share with the public and come back on. And I mean, this is a conversation that could go on for hours and hours. And to me, it was like you doing mental performance training on me. And so I'm very thankful for that because I got it for free.
Well, thanks, Laval. It's great. I mean, it's always a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope I get to see you in the flesh again soon.
Yeah,
and we'll carry the conversation forward.
Exactly. And where can we find out more about you?
Well, I guess the easiest way, I'm not really super active on social media, but on the usual places, Instagram, LinkedIn, I'm at Dr. Chris Bertram. Those would be probably a good place to start.
Right on. Good. Yeah. Thanks for joining us. Really appreciate it, Chris.
Great to see you, Laval.